Red Arms, give it your all.
We'll drink the wine till the cup is dry, and kiss the girl so they'll not cry, and toss the dice until we fly, and dance with Jack of the Shadows.
Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of Tales of a Red Arm. I'm your host, Justin, and we are jumping into Chapter 29, Homecoming. So, obviously from Perrin's perspective from this chapter, and basically they're out in the Westwood area at this point now, and I mean, because it'd be like, when they're in the Wolf Dream, or when I say they, I meant Hopper and him and the other strangers that they met alongside Slayer that they were chasing, or Perrin was chasing, I should say. Nobody else knew about him, really. But in the time that in the Wolf Dream, it had taken them basically a couple strides, like six strides to reach to the, you know, Westwood, Sandhills, and all that stuff, was 3 days, long days on horses. But the Aiel, who were running alongside them, have no trouble keeping up with them, and the animals themselves could eventually not manage the speed at which the land mostly went up and down, as it was. It's pretty much Arkansas. I guess. I don't know. I'm picturing it more like if you went to Colorado, at the, like the base of each mountain, like the roots of the mountain as they kind of like go into the plains and stuff. It's this just big up and down wavy bits of ground, but probably not one side slanted as much as it was. It's probably a bit more just naturally hilly there. But, you know, they're making time, but it's a process because it's not like a paved road or anything taking them straight to where they're going. And at this point, we're not sure exactly where exactly he's going, other than towards, obviously, the two rivers in Emmons Field specifically. But Perrin's wound kind of hurts. The Fael's ointment seems to be working, but it still just hurts and itches. And when your bandages are itching, or I should say, when your wounds that are bandaged are itching, that usually means they're healing. Which is why you're not supposed to itch them, because you could actually break it back open. Fun fact, if you don't know that. But it's a pretty quiet journey, and Fael has a bandage she had with her. And Loyal's riding with Fael, Bane and Chiat, even though Loyal's upset tremendously with, Fael specifically. Obviously not Bane and Chiat, because Bane and Chiat didn't do anything. But Loyal's upset, but to keep the peace, that's what their parents having him do. But Bane and Chiat are basically on either side of Swallow, which is Fael's horse. And occasionally they'll go out and scout ahead and behind and the sides and such. But, yeah, Gaul seems to find this entire thing hilarious, because despite, obviously, Perrin having a bit more, I mean, he's in the middle of this difficult decision where he wants to do something that will let him be with Fael, but at the same time, he realizes what he has to do while he's here, and we've already heard that in previous chapters, where he's basically come to die, but he doesn't want her to stick around, because he doesn't want her to see that, or try to stop it, and then end up being dead herself, kind of a thing. So, it makes sense, but at the same time, I mean, they're both kind of equally stubborn about the thing, even though only one of them knows what's going on. But Gaul seems to find the whole thing amusing. But Perrin just kind of like is thinking, keeping to himself, kind of, or his thoughts, I should say, to himself. And he kept his strung bow across the tall pommel of his saddle, and he's wondering if Slayer was in the Two Rivers only in the Wolf Dream, or if he's actually here in the waking world. And that's something to kind of think about, so tuck that away for later. But Perrin thinks the latter, and that Slayer was the one who had shot the hawk for no reason. And it was another complication he could do without, you know, putting aside the Children of the Light. His family lived on a sprawling farm more than half a day beyond Emmons Field, almost to the Waterwood. his father and mother, his sisters, his baby brother. Patrim would be 9 now, no doubt objecting more strenuously than ever to being called the baby. Dazelle is a plump 12, and Adora, 16, probably ready to braid her hair. Uncle Eward, his Da's brother, and Aunt Meg, stout and looking nearly alike, and their children. Aunt Neen, who visited Uncle Carlin's grave every morning, and their children. And great Aunt Ailsing, who had never married, with her sharp nose and sharper eye for discovering what everyone for miles was around was up to. And that's kind of our little description of his family, since we didn't really get any of that in prior times. Like, I think this is the first time in the entire series so far, which we're in book 4, halfway through it, because we're at the halfway point. This is the first time we get a description of basically his family. With his family, because he's not with his family, he stays with Master Lujan and Elsbeth Lujan because he's an apprentice. And we get the description here where basically the distance was too great for casual travel and there was always work to be done, so he only saw them on feast days. But if the White Cloaks are hunting for Ibaras, they're pretty easy to find. And basically, he's trying to get to his family because they're his responsibility, not Slayer's. And he can only do so much. Now, you might be wondering, why does he think that, you know, him showing up and turning himself in is going to satiate the White Cloaks? And you'd be wondering correctly, because if, obviously, in the White Cloaks' perspective, if one person is a dark friend, everyone in their family clearly must be, because all the evidence, which is none of, points directly to it. You know, oh, you've killed White Cloaks, huh? Well, that means your whole family's murdered entire swaths and armies of White Cloaks, right? I mean, it's the sense in their thinking patterns. But Perrin is determined to protect his family and Fael, and that was the first, but then the village, and then the wolves, and then obviously Slayer's in the back. But he obviously realizes him being one man can't manage all of this by himself. So they eventually get to the Westwood, and it grows on stony soil, broken by brambles, covered outcrops, all that fun jazz. Just very few paths, very few farms. And he used to come to these woods as a boy, either by himself or with Rand and Matt, hunting with a bow or sling. So you got, he has his talents lying with a sling and a bow because he grew up with it. So there's your little backstory showing he knows how to use a couple of those things. And they used to set snares for rabbits and just roam for the sake of roaming. But he could have headed straight for Emmons Field. But instead, he just hits a little bit more northward through the forest and eventually crosses a wide, rough track called the Quarry Road. And they're not sure why it was called Quarry. No one in the Two Rivers really knew, and it scarcely looked like a road at all, only a weedy stretch that you did not even notice was bare of trees until you saw the overgrown ruts from generations of wagons and carts. Sometimes shards of old pavement worked their way to the surface. Perhaps it had led to a quarry for Manetherin. And that's one of those things where we don't have enough information on what exactly it was. I would assume if it's a road that leads towards the mountains, it would make sense to call it a quarry road, because a quarry would make sense to be coming out of a mountain, because mountains typically have a lot of rock and stone. So, makes sense. And if Manetherin was based closer up to the mountain, also makes sense. But Perrin's looking for a particular farm that's not very far from the road, beyond rows of apple and pear trees where the fruit was setting. But he noticed the farm through smell before he ever saw it. And it was char, but not new. A full year would not soften the smell. So they show up at the end of the trees and stare before he makes himself right into what had been the Althor farm. And with the pack horses coming behind him, on the one side, the other stone-walled sheep pen that still stood, railed gate open hanging by one hinge, and obviously the soot-blackened chimney having a slanting shadow across the tumbled, burned beams of the farmhouse. The barn and the tobacco curing shed were just ashes. Weeds were all over throughout the tobacco field and vegetable garden, and the garden had been trampled, so it seemed like, and pretty much everything was trampled, broken, brown. He didn't even think about knocking an arrow because the fire was clearly weeks old. But the burned wood slick and dulled by past rains, you know, choke vine needed nearly a month to grow that tall, and it had enveloped the plow and harrow lying in the field, and rust was showing on the pale, narrow leaves. But the IEL searched carefully, you know, with their eyes wary and spears ready. They checked the ground, poking through the ashes, and then Bane clambered out of the ruins of the house. She looked at Perrin and shook her head, and, you know, well, Tam Althora hadn't died here, so that's good. And Perrin's thinking in his head, like, to Rand, like, you know, they know, you should have come, Rand, you should have come. But it was nearly more than he could do to stop them from putting Stepper to a gallop, keeping him here all the way. Now, that would have been funny, one of the, like, if it was possible, hypothetically, for Rand to get a portal stone to Manetherin or something, right? And just, like, show up with this army of army of Aiel, and just plow through the area, just purging it completely. And be like, yep. It's just like, he showed up, he came, he was there, he saw, he left. But what we got is Perrin, obviously. But, you know, he's like, okay, well. He wanted to gallop, but he had to, like, stop everything from doing that, because Stepper would probably die on the way trying to get that far. And he wants to go all the way to his farm. But then he's like, well, maybe this was Trolloc work. If it was Trolloc's, maybe his family was still working their farm, safe. But the jar obliterated any other smell, so he couldn't really take a deep breath of fresh air. But Gaul pops up and said, whoever did this is long gone. They killed some of the sheep, scattered the rest. Someone came later to gather the flocks and drive it north. Two men, I think, but the tracks are too old to be sure. Now, this is interesting, and you want to keep this kind of tucked away in your head. But it wouldn't be Trollocs. And how do we know this? Well, a Trolloc would probably kill all of the animals and sit there and just eat on it for a long, long time, until whenever. So somebody coming in, killing a couple, which, again, is silly. Why would you kill them and then scatter the rest? Why don't you just scatter them in general? It takes too much time and too much effort to go through, kill a couple, not all of it. So. Now, Perrin is like, any chance you know who did it? Gaul's like, nah, I can't really tell. And it's like, well, it could have been Trollocs. I was like, well, if it's the death of sheep, obviously, like we just mentioned, it's not going to be Trollocs. And if two men came up and, you know, drove all the sheep up north, well, guess what? Definitely not Trollocs. But he thinks it's probably Trollocs that probably burned the entire farmstead down. But again, very little evidence of that, and obviously they wouldn't have drove them up north, considering it's humans, not Trollocs. But yeah, it's like, I mean, hoping that it's the Trollocs is kind of foolish and a little strange. But the White Cloaks know his name, and they know Rand's, and assumingly they probably know Matt's in some shape or form. But he's like, well, he looks at the ashes of the Althora farmhouse, and then he's starting to, like, tremble. But Loyal had dismounted near the fruit trees, and he's like, do you know who people who lived here? And he's like, Rand and his father. He's like, oh, yeah. But, and when I say, you know, who said, do you know the people who live there? That was Fael, not Loyal. Sorry. I probably should have clarified a little bit better. That Loyal had dismounted, but then it was Fael who asked if they knew the people there. And it was a little bit of relief, but also sympathy. And he was like, well, does your family live near here? And he was like, no. But he said it in such a way that she kind of recoiled as if he slapped her. And she still watched him, waiting, but he's like, what do I got to do to drive her away? Like, but it's more than he could really bring himself to actually do, considering he didn't think he had already managed to do that already. But the sun's starting to hit the treetops, and he reins Stepper around, rudely turning his back on her. He's like, Gaul, we'll have to camp close by tonight. I want to start off early in the morning. So he sneaked a glance over his shoulder at Fael's riding back to Loyal, and she's sitting stiff in her saddle. And he's like, well, in Emmonsfield, they know, or they will know. He's like, where the white cloaks were, but he turned his back on her and turned back on himself before anything else. But he was so concerned with turning himself in before they could hurt his family. But again, I don't think they would stop with just him. It's pretty obvious they wouldn't. But if his family's all right, you know, the farm where he'd been born was not really like this. It's like, well, no, he has to stop that from ever happening, whether it be white cloaks or Trollocs. It's like, oh, well, Emmonsfield will know how things are. And Gaul's like, early then. But then Gaul kind of pauses, and it's like, you're not going to drive her off. That one's almost far to rise mine. If a maiden loves you, you cannot escape her however hard you run. And I would recommend you tuck that away for later, because it comes into play. But yes. And he's like, well, you let me worry about Fael. But he softened his voice, and he's like, very early, while Fael is still asleep. So the camp's, you know, sitting underneath the apple trees, a bit quiet. You know, several times one of the other Aiel women stood, not sure if it was Bane or Chiad, but they stare towards the small fire him and Gaul had sat at, but there were very few sounds. But Perrin couldn't sleep, and it was still an hour short of first light with the full moon setting, so him and Gaul then slip away, and the Aiel silent in his soft boots, and the horse's hooves making little more noise. Bane, or possibly Chian, you know, watched them go. But he couldn't tell which, but they didn't wake Fael, and he's grateful. Well, I mean, I'm sure that they would wake her at some point. Just as far as he knows, as far as him leaving, they didn't wake her up. Because obviously she probably would have caught up really quick. But the sun climbed up well by the time they came out of the Westwood, a little below the village. Amid cart tracks, paths, and all that stuff. But Perrin keeps Stepper going at a fast walk, despite boys watching black-faced sheep in the pastures. Nobody was close enough to really recognize him or wonder at the strangeness of Gaul's clothes or spears. But people would be out and about in Emmons Field, so he circled around to the east, wide of the village, wide of the hard-packed dirt streets and thatched roofs clustered in the ground of the green. And then we get the description of the wine spring. So the wine spring itself gushed from a stone outcrop with enough force to knock a man down and give birth to the wine spring water. Just kind of like their local... I'm guessing it's just a well that comes out of an outcrop of stone as opposed to just the ground directly. And like upwards, I guess. It's more comes forward rather than up, if that makes sense. It's almost like they had piping or something. But it seems like all the damage from Winter's Night a year ago, burn houses and everything, seems to all been rebuilt and repaired, and the Trollocs might as well have never been there. And he prays that they never have to experience it again. And then we get the description of the Winespring Inn. And the Winespring Inn stood practically at the eastern end of the Emmons Field, between the stout wooden wagon bridge across the rushing Winespring water and a huge old stone foundation with a great oak growing up through the middle of it. Tables beneath the thick branches were where folks sat on a fine afternoon and watched the play at bowls. They're empty at this time of day. But there were only a few houses farther east. The inn itself was river rock on the first floor, with a whitewashed second story jutting out all the way around and dozen chimneys rising above the glittering red tile roof, their only tile roof for miles. And it's amazing to think of that, like, this two-story building having a dozen chimneys. That just blows my mind. Like, how many chimneys? I can imagine a couple big ones and perhaps a couple in the middle to, like, if you have rooms, they have, like, a shared chimney where they kind of go up and they both let out smoke. That makes sense to me, but, like, a dozen? That's a lot. Especially for, I mean, how big? Because I don't think it has more than, like, 10 rooms, maybe? It doesn't have that many, but the common room, which would have its own chimney, possibly two, depending on how big the common room was. But it's not like we get a square footage for how big the Winespring Inn is. But he ties Stepper and the pack horse to a hitch post near the kitchen door, and then looked at the thatch roof stable. He could hear men working in there. It's probably Hu and Tad. Now, Hugh and Tad are the stablemen, if you remember from book one. And Master Alvear kept the Big Durin team, which are the really big. They're kind of like what you consider like the Budweiser horses that you see on like Christmas commercials or whatever. Like the really, really big, heavy ones that like pull lots of weight. But he rents them out for heavy hauling, but they're at the stables. But there's other sounds on the other side of the inn with the murmur of the voices on the green, geese honking, rumble of a wagon, you know, all the sounds you expect from a village in the early hours of the morning. But he left everything on his horse that was on the horse, and he was planning on making it a short stop. So him and Gaul head inside before either Hugh or Tad show up. But the kitchen was kind of empty, and everything but one fireplace was cold, and through the smell of baking was hanging in the air, bread and honey cakes, which is what Marin Alvear was known for, the honey cake specifically. But the inn seldom had guests, except when merchants came down from Barilon to buy wool or tobacco, or a monthly peddler when snow had not made the road impassable, and the village folk, who might come for a drink or a meal later in the day, would all be hard at work at their own homes by now. But someone might be there. So Perrin kind of tiptoes in and cracks open the door to the common room, peeks inside. And he had seen the square room 1,000 times, the fireplace of river stone stretching half the room's length, the lintel as high as a man's shoulder, Master Elvire's polished tobacco canister and prized clocks sitting on the mantel. And it all seemed much smaller than it had, somehow. It's probably because a year passes, you've gotten bigger, probably. Even before that, it's probably because he's seen how big the world is and things in the world and how big they are. And then, like, obviously having Loyal nearby. Loyal's huge to all this stuff. But it seems small compared to that. But the tall back chairs in front of the fireplace where the village council met. Brandelwyn Alvear is his full name, by the way. Everyone calls him Bran. His book sat on a shelf opposite the fireplace, and Perrin had been unable to imagine more books in one place than a few dozen mostly worn volumes, and casks of ale and wine lined another wall. Scratch, the inn yellow cat, sprawled asleep as usual atop one of them. But beside Bran Alvear himself and his wife Marin in long white aprons polishing everything, the common room stood empty. Master Alvear was a wide, round man with a sparse fringe of gray hair, and Mistress Alvear was slender and motherly. Her thick and graying braid pulled over. Man, I can't talk today. I apologize. pulled over one shoulder. She smelled of baking and under that of roses. Perrin remembered them as smiling people, but both looked intent now, and the mayor wore a frown that surely had nothing to do with the silver cup in his hand. But he pushed it open the door and says, "Master Alvear, Mistress Alvear, it's Perrin." They jumped to their feet, knocking their chairs over, making Scratch even jump. Mistress Alvear clapped her hands to her mouth, and her husband gaped as much at him as they did at Gaul, and it was enough to make Perrin shift his bow awkwardly from hand to hand. Now, I just find this funny because it's like, imagine it's like, "Hey, hi guys, it's me, I'm back," and then they turn around and this is totally different looking guy who looks like he's, you know, wearing like a dust cloak or something, and he looks like he's been traveling, and he's kind of travel-worn, and then they look over, and they see this guy in, like, browns and grays, and probably, at this point, a little bit of green, and they look almost like bandits, probably, at first glance. seeing that picture would be hilarious to see. But, Bran kind of hurries out to one of the front windows. He moves surprising lightness for one of his bulk and twitched the summer curtains aside to peer out, as though for more Aiel outside. And Marin's like, "Perrin, it is you. I almost didn't know you with that beard and your cheek. Is Egwene with you?" Perrin touched the half-healed slash across his cheek, self-consciously, wishing he had cleaned up or at least left the bow and axe in the kitchen. He hadn't considered how his appearance might frighten them. He's like, no, this doesn't have anything to do with her. She's fine. And, you know, on her way back to Tarvalon, perhaps, but it's better than still in tear with Rand, but safe either case. But he supposed he had to give Egwene's mother something more than that. He's like, "Well, she's studying to be an Aes Sedai, and Nynaeve as well." I'm like, "Yeah, I know. We have 3 letters from her in Tarvalon, but what she writes, she sent more. Nynaeve, at least one, but only 3 of Egwene's have reached us. She tells something of her training, which I must say sounds very hard. And I'm like, it's not like you guys have a postal service that would deliver all this to you in this time period. Like, you're out in the middle of nowhere. So basically, if a peddler doesn't come in, you get no news. So I don't know how they have their mail system. Maybe it's like in Barillon or something, or maybe in Tarn Ferry. They have to go pick up the P.O. box or something. I don't know. I don't understand how that would work. So, I mean, whether they did it in Barillon or whatever, I don't know. I don't understand how they do this. But yeah, apparently Egwene's training is really difficult, according to Mr. Salvier from Egwene. And he's like, well, that's what she wants. It's like 3 letters. But then he kind of feels guilty because he hadn't written a single letter to anyone. Not since the notes he left for his family and Master Luhan the night Moraine took him away from Emmons Field. I was like, well, it seems not... That's not even what I envisioned for her, but it isn't something I can tell many people about, really, is it? But she made friends anyway. Nice girls by the sound of them. Elaine and Min, do you know them? I was like, oh, we've met. I think you could call them nice girls. I like it. I think you could call them nice girls, as in, like, are they, though? But he's not sure how much Egwene had told in the letters. Not very much. It's not like, hey, by the way, Rand is Dragon Reborn. Little details matter. But Mistress Alvear was going to think what she would, and Perrin was content with, you know, her thinking that. And he's I'm not going to worry her over things she can't really do anything. What was past is past, and Egwene's safe enough. Then he realized that Gaul was just standing there, and he made hasty introductions. Bran blinked when Gaul was named Aiel. He frowned at his spears and the black veil hanging down his chest from a shufa. But his wife merely said, "Be welcome to Emmons Field, Master Gaul, and to the Wine Spring Inn." And Gaul formally bows to her and says, "May you always have water and shade, roof mistress. I ask leave to defend your hold, your roof and your hold." And she barely hesitates before replying that as if that were exactly what she was used to hearing. It's like, "Ah, gracious offer, but you must allow me to decide when it is needed." He's like, "As you say, roof mistress, your honor is mine." And from under his cloak, he produces this gold salt cellar, a small bowl balanced on the back of a cunningly made lion, and extended it to her. "I offer this small guest gift to your roof." it's funny because she just takes it in stride, and Bran's just there with wide eyes, like, what is going on? But Meryn Alvear just is like, "Oh, thank you for the gift," and doesn't like show much of her shock. And his parents like, "I doubt there's a piece equal to it in the whole Two Rivers, and definitely not in gold. There was little enough gold coin in the Two Rivers, much less gold ornaments." But he hoped she never found out that it had been looted from the Stone of Tyr. At least he would have wagered that, and it had. I mean, it's amazing to me, like, how much they carry on them, and they can still travel, because, like, as we'll see soon, there's something, like, really big that's traveling with the group, and it's like, Are you going around with that? Like that makes absolutely no sense. Why are you like going perusing around the area? Just like, you know, it's like, oh, well, we're gonna make a quick trip through the ways. We're gonna, you know, fight Trollocs, get chased out by Machin Shin, potentially get poked to death by ravens and hordes of those, and we're gonna possibly run into white cloaks and everything. But let me take all my golden goodies with me, which I mean, I understand they fought for it and that's their pretty much their pay, so it makes sense. But at the same time, it's just like, how do you realistically travel with that? Unless he's like carrying on a, I mean, I suppose it could be on the pack horse, but does Gaul like will run up to the pack horse, quickly pull something out, stuff it in his, like, I don't know, a little pouch on the side of his hip or something, and be like, "I'm gonna carry this in because I'm gonna, you know, give it as a gift because reasons." It's just kind of strange. But Bran's like, maybe I should be saying welcome home, but why did you return? He's like, "Well, I heard about the white cloak, sir." They shared looks and was like, "Again, why did you return? You can't stop anything, my boy, or change anything. It's best that you go. And if you don't have a horse, I'll give you one. Just climb back in your saddle and ride north. I thought the white cloaks were guarding Taron Ferry. Did they give you that decoration?" He's like, "No." He's like, "Well, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. Just get past, you got past them coming in, you can get past to leave. Their main camp is up at Watch Hill, but the patrols can be anywhere. Do it." He's like, and Marin's like, "Don't wait, Perrin. Not even an hour. I'll make you a bundle to take with you. Some fresh bread and cheese, ham, roast beef, pickles. You must go." He's like, "I can't. You know they're after me, and or you'd not want me to go." They hadn't commented on his eyes yet, but even to mention, like, "Are you feeling sick? Are you, like, what's going on?" But Mr. Sill had barely been surprised. They knew. He's like, if I give myself up, I can stop some of it. I can keep my family. He jumped as the hall door banged open to admit Fail with Bane and Shiot on her heels. And this is where I was saying, it's like, they didn't wake her up immediately, but they didn't not wake her up. Or possibly she woke up on her own, but more likely Bane and Shiot, one of them woke him up. But Bran ran a hand over his bald head, taking in the Aiel women's garb and obviously identifying them with Gaul, but he seemed only a little bemused that they were women. But he looked a little irritated at the intrusion, and Scratch sat up to stare suspiciously at all the strangers, and Perrin wondered if he was one of those strangers. He wondered how they had found him and where Loyal was. So anything to avoid wondering how he's going to manage Fail at this point. But she gives him a little time to ponder, but not very much, basically instantaneously. Planting herself in front of him with fists on hips, and somehow she managed that trick women had, making herself seem taller through pure quivering outrage. Give yourself up. Give yourself up. Have you been planning this from the start? You have, haven't you? You utter idiot. Your brain was frozen solid, Perrin Ibarra. It is nothing but muscle and hair to begin with, but now it isn't even that. If White Cloaks are hunting you, they will hang you if you surrender to them. Why should they want you? And he's like, because I killed White Cloaks. And he ignored Mr. Salvier's gasp. He's like, those the night I met you and two before that, but they know of those two and they think I'm a dark friend. And she would learn about that soon enough, but eventually you'd have to tell her why, and they had been alone, or had they been alone. But at least two White Cloaks, Jeffrem Bornhold and Jarrett Byer, suspected something of his connection with wolves. Not nearly all, but for them little was enough. A man who ran with wolves had to be a dark friend. And I point this particular line out because it's one of those perceptions versus truth, I guess, where it's true that the perception is a man who ran with wolves had to be a dark friend from the perspective of the White Cloaks and potentially random people, if that was the view they took. But not many people run into that situation to even know that to begin with, so no one's going to think about it, which is why Perrin can go to pretty much anywhere outside of White Cloak territory and be fine. Because nobody cares. Because nobody thinks about that except for the White Cloaks. So there's a few things you kind of have to allow in that regard. To be, is it true statement or is it reality? Is it a perception? What is it exactly? And personally, I see it as it's the White Cloaks' perception. It's obviously not a true reality. It's not men who run with wolves are dark friends. It's the White Cloaks deem men who run with wolves as to be dark friends. So it's not quite the same thing, but it doesn't really matter because ultimately the White Cloaks will believe whatever they want to believe because that's what they're known for, is believing whatever they want to believe, and believing they're always right is one of those things they always believe. Believing everybody else on the planet is a dark friend that argues with them or debates them or prevents them from doing what they deem is the right thing. Those are all dark friends. But I'm like, okay, well, if you show up in a country and that country has a king or a queen or maybe a council or whatever it might be, and you start trying to throw your way around and the guards show up and be like, hey, you don't have jurisdiction here. And be like, you're a dark friend, is kind of like the go-to that they do that. But I'm like, you also wouldn't say that to the guard because the guard's only letting a limited amount of you in. And that means if you come in, you ain't going out. If you mess with whoever the head honcho is of that place, like, but in villages, obviously they don't have to worry about that unless that village has guards from those head honchos in them. Or perhaps a larger amount. If it's like a larger place like Barallon, well, I guess Barallon's, I mean, it's not really large, but it also depends on the percentage of White Cloaks to maybe Town Watch or something. The Town Watch is probably not going to let them just run rampant because their job is to prevent them from causing problems. And if the White Cloaks are causing problems and just declaring, like, calling somebody a dark friend from a White Cloak perspective is probably the same as calling somebody any whatever buzzword might be in society or culture at the time as, like, a really bad person, but doing it literally for any reason. Which sadly probably happens more than it should, but they'll do the dragon fangs. They'll convince other people who kind of agree with them or have an issue with the person they're targeting to do the Dragon Fang and be like, oh, look, they're dark friends. But like everybody's like, we're just going to ignore it because it doesn't matter. Everyone here knows everyone, kind of a thing in smaller places. The bigger places would be a little bit more difficult. But even then, people who get caught putting that on there are probably not going to have a happy day. But needless to say, the difference in perception, reality, and like the actual objective truth, like, is a man who runs with wolves a dark friend? Not necessarily. I find it hard to believe that any of them would be able to, considering the wolves and their sentiments towards the Dark One, and obviously Trollocs, the Twisted Ones, Fades, the Eyeless, whatever you want to call them, Harksbane, all of those different names they have for them. They absolutely despise evil. So it makes me very unlikely to believe that anybody who runs with wolves is a dark friend from a logical perspective, considering us as the reader slash viewer, listener, whatever it might be. We see how they behave. This is not how they behave, because we've seen the wolves' perspective. We've seen parents' perspective. We've seen somewhat of Elias's perspective. We've seen even Aes Sedai and other people. We've seen the White Cloaks. The White Cloaks make accusations all the time without any actual evidence. So it's not crazy to say they don't know what they're talking about. So it is what it is in that regard. But yeah. So Fael's obviously like, you're no more of a dark friend than I am. The sun could be a dark friend first. And he's like, well, clearly it doesn't matter because they'll believe it no matter what. So I have to do what I have to do, Fael. It's like, you addle-brained lummox. I love saying that. You don't have to do any such crackpate thing. You goose brain. If you try it, I'll hang you myself. And it's like, well, then he's getting his wish either way. But then you have to give the body to the White Cloak so they can actually do that, which obviously you probably wouldn't do. But Marin's like, Perrin, would you introduce me to this young woman who thinks so highly of you? And Fael's face went bright red when she realized she had been ignoring Master and Mistress Alvir, and began making elaborate curtsies and offering flowery apologies. And Bane and Chia did the same as Gaul, asking leave to defend Mistress Alvir's roof and giving her a small golden bowl worked in leaves and an ornate silver pepper mill bigger than Perrin's two fists. That's the thing I was talking about earlier. It's like, Perrin's fists are huge, and this thing's going to be pretty big. That's going to be like a foot long, if not bigger than that. And obviously, fists on top of that, it's probably a foot long or longer, and then like 6 to 8 inches thick. Like, that's a big item to be carrying around with you. So it has to be coming on the pack horses, I'd imagine. But how? Like, it's just strange. But it was topped by some fanciful creature, half horse, half fish. I have no idea what that could even be. When I said half horse, you're thinking, oh, centaur. And it's like half fish. I'm like, well, I don't know what that could be. What is a half horse, half fish? Maybe a seahorse, maybe? I don't know. A seahorse isn't actually a horse and doesn't actually look like a horse, so I doubt it, but I don't know. Bran Alvir was just frowning as he stared and rubbed his head, muttering about himself, and he cut the herd Aiel more than once in an incredulous tone. But the mare kept glancing out the windows, clearly wondering about more Aiel, but he had been surprised to learn Gaul at Aiel, and maybe he was worried about White Cloaks. But Myron was just like, all right, and she treats Fael and Bane and Shea the same as any other young woman travelers came in to the inn, and commiserating with them over how tiring travel was, complimenting Fael on her riding dress, which is dark blue silk, if you needed to know, and telling the Aiel woman how she admired their color and sheen of their hair. She suspected Bane and Shead, at least, did not know quite what to make of her, but in short, with a calm, motherly firmness, she had all three women settled at a table with damp towels to wipe the journey dust from their hands and faces. Sipping teas, she poured from a large red-striped pot he remembered well. And it was kind of amusing to Perrin to see those fierce women, indefinitely included Fael, suddenly eager to assure Mistress Alvir that they were more than comfortable and that there was nothing they could do to help. Now, from Fael's perspective, it's somebody who has known Perrin for a long, 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 long time. And for the Aiel, it's the roof mistress. You do as the roof mistress says. So they're all just like, no, I'm supposed to do something for you, not the other way around. And during this whole thing, he thought it would be really funny. They're all kind of like wide-eyed, like children with no chance of resisting her. And it was kind of amusing to him, but he and Gaul got included and they got swept to the table. But the entire time, Gaul wore a small grin the entirety of it. And just, Aiel had a strange sense of humor, which, to be fair, they do. They have a very strange sense of humor. Sometimes I feel like I can understand it. And other times I'm just like, I got no idea what you're talking about. But obviously, she never glanced at his bow or axe and the Aiel's weapons, just treating them like guests. People seldom carried even a bow in the Two Rivers, and she always insisted on them being set out aside before anyone took place at one of her tables. Always. But she just ignored them. Now, this is important because in most situations, you'd be like, why do you even add this detail? Like, why is it important? The importance is because it explains the severity of the situation. Is this actually as bad as people are expecting it to be? Or is this just kind of people making it up like, oh, because if everything was at peace, there was no white cloaks, there's no enemies about or whatever, nothing was going downhill in the territory, no farms were being burned or whatever, and everything was just great and dandy like it was before Winter's Night, she probably would have left, like, you got to leave this stuff out there. But knowing that everything, let alone violence, could potentially be a thing that happens, not dealing with that. It's safer for the people involved, especially the people she cares about, which would be at least Perrin. And then on top of Perrin, probably Faile, because Faile thinks highly of Perrin. And that means a lot to Mistress Alvir. And then obviously the three Aiel, which seem to be friends of Perrin / Faile. In this situation, it would be kind of like a, you know, the friend of my friend is my friend kind of thing. Needless to say. But then Bran placed a silver cup of apple brandy at Perrin's elbow, and not the small one that the men usually drank at the end, but barely enough to cover the last joint of the thumb, but half full. And he wouldn't have only been offered cider if not milk, perhaps well-watered wine, half a cup with a meal or a full one on a feast day. But he liked being recognized as a grown man, but he only held it. He was used to wine now, but he seldom drank anything stronger. And Bran's like, well, Perrin, no one believes you a dark friend. No one with any sense. And there's no reason for you to let yourself be hanged. And Faile's obviously adamant about agreeing with that. But Perrin's like, I won't be turned aside. The White Cloaks want me, and if they do not get me, they might turn to the next Abaro they can find. White Cloaks don't need much to decide somebody's guilty, and they are not pleasant people. And they're like, we know. But then Bran breaks some crazy news. Perrin, your family is gone. And Perrin's like, what, you mean the farm is burned already? And he tightened around the silver cup, his fist a little bit. He's like, I hoped I was in time. I should have known better, I suppose, a little long before I heard. But maybe I can help my Da and Uncle Eward rebuild. Who are they staying with? I want to see them first, at least. But Bran grimaced, and Marin just strokes his shoulder comfortingly. But her eyes were staying on Perrin, just sadness and comfort. But Bran's like, they're dead, my boy. It's like, dead? No, they can't be. And he frowned as wetness suddenly slopped over his hand, and he stared at the crumpled cup as though wondering where it had come from. He had basically taken the silver cup and just crushed it in his hand. He pulled at the flattened silver, trying to force it back together with his fingers, but obviously it wouldn't work. But very carefully, he put the ruined cup in the middle of the table. He's like, I'll replace it. I can... Are you sure? He wiped his hand on his coat, but he found he was caressing the axe hanging on his belt. Why was everyone looking at him so oddly? But his voice sounded distance away. He's like, Adora, Dazelle, Pate, my mom? Brad's like, all of them. Aunts and uncles, too. Cousins, everybody on the farm. I helped bury them on that low hill, the one with the apple trees. And Perrin stuck his thumb in his mouth, full thing, you know, cutting himself on his own axe. He's like, well, my mother likes apple blossoms. The White Cloaks, why would they? Burn me, Pate was only 9. The girls? And his voice was very flat. He thought they should have more emotion in those words, some emotion. And Marin's like, it was Trollocs. They've come back, Perrin. Not the way they did when you were away, not attacking the village, but out in the countryside. Most farms without close neighbors have been abandoned. No one goes outside at night, even near to the village. It's the same down to Devon Ride and up to Watch Hill, and maybe to Tarn Ferry. The White Cloaks, bad as they are the only real protection. They've saved two families that I know of when Trollocs attacked their farms. Now, something seems fishy if you are paying attention, so keep paying attention. It's like, I wished, I hoped. What about Rand's father, Tam's farm? Was that Trollocs too? But Bran cut off Maron, who was about to say something. He's like, he deserves the truth, Maron. That was White Cloaks. That and the Coffin's place. It's like, oh, Matt people too. Rand and Matt's and mine? Are they dead too? It's like, no, no. Abel and Tam are hiding in the Westwood somewhere, and Matt and mother's sisters, they're alive. Hiding? And the Maron's like, no need to go into that. Bran, bring him another cup of brandy, and you drink this one, Perrin. It's just like, you drink this. And her husband sat where he was, but she only frowned at him and went on. He's like, well, I would offer you a bed, but it isn't safe. Some people are like as to not run off hunting for Lord Bornhold, as if they find out you are here. Edward Conger and Harry Coplin fawn after the White Cloaks like heel hounds, eager to please and name names. Senbui isn't much better. Wit Conger will carry tales, too, if Daze doesn't stop him. She's the wisdom now. It's better for you to go, Perrin. Believe me. And Perrin's like, what? Daze Conger is the wisdom? The woman was like a bull. Which I love the description. But yeah. He's like, White Cloaks protecting Emmons Field. Hari and Edward and Wit cooperating. Not much could be expected from Congress and Coplins, but Senbui was on the village council. Lord Bornhold. So Jeff from Bornhold was there. Fael's watching him with her eyes large and moist. Why would she be on the edge of tears? And Gaul's like, there is more, Brandelwyn Alvear. Your face says so. He's like, there is. No, Maron. She gave a small shake of her head. He's like, no, he deserves the truth. The whole truth. And he's like, what? And she sighs. Bran's face was set now, with his eyebrows drawn down hard as a plow. He's like, what truth? His mother really did like apple blossoms. Well, first, Pedon Fane is with the White Cloaks, but he calls himself Ordeath now. And he won't answer to his own name at all, but it's him. Stare down his nose as he will. Parents was like, oh, he's a dark friend. But then he talks about his sisters. Adora and Dazelle always put apple blossoms in their hair in the spring. Admitted from his own mouth, he brought the Trollocs on Winter's Night. Pate liked to climb in the apple trees. He would like to throw apples at you from the branches if he did not watch them. And Mare's like, oh, is he now? That's interesting. But he has some form of authority with the White Cloaks. First we heard they were here was after they burned Tam's farm. That was Fane's work. He led the White Cloaks that did it. Tam's feathered four or five of them with arrows before he made it to the woods. And reached the Cawthon farm in the nick of time to stop them from taking Abel. But they rested Natty and the girls. And Harl, Luhan, and Alsbit. Think Fane might have hung them, except Lord Bornhold wouldn't allow it. Not that he let them go, either. They haven't been harmed, as far as I can discover, but they're being held in the White Cloak camp up at Watch Hill. But oddly enough, Fane hates you for some reason. You and Rand and Matt, but he'd offered 100 pieces of gold for anyone related to the three of you, 200 for Tam or Abel, and Lord Bornhold seems to have some interest in you especially. When a White Cloak patrol comes here, he usually comes too and asks questions about you. Perrin's like, well, of course he would. He would. Perrin of the Two Rivers who ran with wolves, dark friend. Fane could have told him the rest. But Fane with the Children of the Light? Better than thinking about Trollocs, though. He grimaced at his hands and made them be still on the table. They protect you from the Trollocs. Maron leans forward, frowning. Perrin, we need the White Cloaks. Yes, they burned Tam's farm and Abel. They've arrested people, and they stamp around as if they own everything they see. But Alsbit and Natty and the rest are unharmed, only held. Well, you know they're held. You don't know if they're unharmed. And the rest can be straightened out somehow. The Dragon's Vein had been scrawled on a few doors, and nobody except the Congers and Coplins panty mind. And they're likely the ones who did the scrawling. Tam and Abel can stay in hiding until the White Cloaks go. They have to go sooner or later, but as long as there are Trollocs here, we do need them. Please understand. It's not that we would rather have... It's not that we would not rather have you than them, but we need them and we don't want them to hang you. And Bane's like, you call this being protected, Roof Mistress. If you ask the line to protect you from wolves, you have only chosen to end in one belly instead of another. And she adds, like, can you not protect yourselves? I have seen Perrin fight, and Matt Cawthon and Randall Thor. They are the same blood as you. Well, two of them. One's just right there. Bran's like, we're just farmers, simple people. Lord Luke talks of organizing men to fight the Trollocs, but that means leaving your family unprotected while you go off with him, and no one likes that idea much. And Perrin's confused, like, who's this Lord Luke? But Mistress Alvir responds with, oh, he came about the same time the White Cloaks did, but he's a hunter of the Horn. You know the story, the Great Hunt of the Horn. Lord Luke thinks that the Horn of Valyr is somewhere in the Mountains of Mist above the Two Rivers. But he gave over his hunt because of our problems. He's a great gentleman, with the finest manners. And she smooths her hair and gave an approving smile. And Bran looks at her sideways and grunts sourly. It's not like he has to worry about competition, but apparently this guy's an attractive fellow that has the women swooning. But then he's like, Hunter's the Horn. You got Trollocs, White Cloaks. Man, the Two Rivers is a lot busier than the place I remember. He's like, oh, Fael's a hunter of the Horn, too. Do you know this Lord Luke Fael? And she just stands up and is just like, I've had enough. And he frowns and she comes over around and grabs his head and thrusts his face into her midriff. She's like, your mother is dead. Your father is dead. Your sisters are dead. And your brother. Your family is dead. And you cannot change it. Certainly not by dying yourself. Let yourself grieve. Don't hold it inside where it can fester. And he takes her by the arms, meaning to move her. But for some reason, his hands just tightened till that grip was the only thing holding him up. It was only then that he realized he was crying, sobbing into her dress like a baby. What must she think of him? He opened his mouth to tell her he was all right, to apologize for breaking down. But what came out was, I couldn't get here any faster. I couldn't. He grits his teeth to shut himself off, and she's like, I know, and stroking his hair for all the world as if he were a child. I know. He wanted to stop, but the more she whispered understanding, the more he wept, as though her hands, soft on his head, were smoothing the tears out of him. That's one way to end a chapter. And for anybody who has experienced loss of some sort, they could probably relate to this. I've had my own instances of that kind of thing where it kind of, reading that kind of reminds me of the instances that I've experienced, and it's rough. It is really rough. The most stoic man can break down in that instance. Like, imagine if Lan, who clearly loves Nynaeve, saw Nynaeve die, or heard that she died, and he would just probably lose it, you'd think. Because she's the most important thing to him. And obviously, Malkier is a very close second, but like, he has his war for Malkier to play, but he'd probably abandon that, at least temporarily, to do whatever he could for Nynaeve. So, it's quite the, it's quite the experience. And it's not one I would really wish on anybody, but people will naturally probably come through it. Probably not the same way that Perrin did, where somebody actively killed his family. But in most situations, it's still going to hurt. And it's still going to be something that even the most stoic of men can probably break down and cry. So, I know it was a bit of a heavy ending to that chapter, but what did you guys think about the chapter as a whole? The descriptions of the areas, the locations, the places. We didn't get a whole lot of them early on. I mean, there were some. This one got a little bit more specific, especially when it comes to, like, the wine spring itself. So, the interesting kind of almost comedic antics of the interaction between the Aiel and the Alvears and all that kind of stuff. Perrin trying to basically irritate Faile out of his life, and then her coming to the eventual knowledge that he's trying to come here to die, and she's like, well, screw that noise. It's like, burn my soul, I'm not going to let you die. It's basically what it is. But him hearing the news of his family, hearing about Tam and Abel, and then the Natty and the girls, and obviously Harl and Elizabeth Lujan. Like, it's just, it. The White Cloaks are a menace in pretty much every situation. They come into people's lives because they just, like, grab people up and say, I'm going to just execute you because I feel like it, because I think you looked at me wrong, and that's what a dark friend would do. And that's kind of, and if you remember the early ones, early episodes, like, that's what a dark friend would do. It makes sense. But yes. Yeah. Let me know what you guys thought. That was chapter 29. And we got chapter 30 coming up. If you guys would like to give any input or let me know what you think about the chapter itself. Just feel free to reach out through Facebook or Twitter/X. Facebook is just Tales of Erdarm. Twitter/X is at Tales of Erdarm. And then we also have a Discord. And if you have Discord or use Discord, you can join the Discord page. Well, I guess Discord server specifically. But and we're going to kind of use it like a forum type thing where you can talk in different areas. If you want spoilers, you can be in one that spoilers. If you want one without spoilers because you're new, you can go into the one that talks without it, and basically you won't have to worry about anything. But yeah, love to have you guys there. You can chat. I'm on Discord basically every single day, so if you're in there and you have a question or something, you can always ask me there. Also on Twitter/X or on Facebook, and even on things like Discord, you can possibly get a chance to chat with me through voice chat, and I can answer questions if that is a thing, or we can just talk about theories or information that I might have left out or hadn't brought up because it wasn't in this particular sections I'm in. Anything like that, it'd be fun. You can get that link to the Discord through the Facebook or the Twitter/X page. But if you cannot find it or it's not operating like it's supposed to be, you can reach out to me through my email directly, which is talesofredarm@gmail.com. And you can reach out to me there directly if you don't use Discord or Facebook, Twitter/X or anything. And you can leave your feedback there. I'd love to hear from you guys. It's always fun having people talk about Wheel of Time because it's a very endearing series. And I love it to death. It's almost as good as Tolkien's work, but it's definitely second place compared to Tolkien, but it's definitely really far up there. It's been a while since I've read pretty much anything else fantasy, specifically because of my love for this. I just kind of reread it over and over again. So, but yeah, let me know what you guys think. I look forward to hearing from you guys in Discord or through email or whatever. So thanks everybody for hanging around. We'll see you for chapter 30. Until then.
We drink all night and dance all day, and on the girls we'll spend our pay, and when we're done then we'll away to dance with Jack of the Shadows. We'll toss the dice however they fall, and snuggle the girls be they short or tall, and follow young Matt wherever he calls to dance with Jack of the Shadows. We'll toss the dice however they fall, and snuggle the girls be they short or tall, then follow Lord Matt wherever he calls to dance with Jack of the Shadows. We'll give a yo with a bloody curse, and hog the mags, it could be worse, as run away with the dark ones first, to dance with Jack of the Shadows. Yeah!